Whenever we debate the existence of God or the workings of creation, we engage with St. Augustine. Why is there evil in the world? What constitutes happiness? How should we understand the relationship between our minds and our bodies, or between our words and the reality they struggle to describe? What matters most, faith, reason, or feeling? All these fundamental questions Augustine submitted to the very closest scrutiny. But Augustine also identified a profound tension between Christianity and classics, in what he wrote and in the kind of man he was. In the year 386, he was resident in Milan, the political capital of the Western Empire and home to the emperor's court. There he had reached the height of a secular career as speaker of court panegyrics and professor of rhetoric, the devices used in classical Latin to construct persuasive arguments. And there, in Milan, he experienced conversion to the Christian faith and was baptized. So Augustine abandoned his imperial profession and a life of the flesh. He returned home to Africa, a province at the southern edge of the empire. There he pursued instead a life of Christian celibacy, prayer, study and preaching, becoming first priest and then bishop of the busy seaport Hippo. Augustine's life thus forms a bridge between the Western world's classical past and his Christian future. In his writings, he was the most important critic of classical antiquity's values and beliefs, yet, at the same time, he imparted those values and beliefs to the medieval and modern world. Augustine wrote and preached during a time of extreme religious and political turbulence. After earlier persecutions and martyrdoms, Christianity had become the official religion of the empire. A ban was placed on pagan worship, yet violent disputes over orthodoxy broke up the Christian communities. The Roman Empire split into Western and Eastern halves during Augustine's lifetime, and the Visigoths sacked Rome. As the bishop lay dying, his own city came under siege from Vandal armies. With the political institutions and the religious practices of the classical world undergoing such sweeping transformations, it is no wonder that its literary and philosophical culture also came under attack. Once installed as spiritual leader in Hippo, Augustine wrote an account of his conversion called the Confessiones, meaning both a confession of his faults and an acknowledgement of his faith. The most celebrated of all ancient autobiographies, it has spoken to Christians from late antiquity to the present about sin and redemption, and to non-Christians about a man's inner life, his capacity for self-awareness and for rebirth. At the beginning of the Confessions, Augustine represents himself as pupil rather than teacher, in a time long before he became one of our Latin voices. He describes his childhood education as a thoroughly miserable experience, full of misdirected teaching and pointless beatings, of value only as preparation for the expected miseries of adulthood.
Even now I have not yet discovered the reasons why I hated Greek literature when I was being taught it as a small boy. Latin I deeply loved, not at the stage of my primary teachers, but at the secondary level, taught by the teachers of literature called grammarians. The initial elements, where one learns the three R's of reading, writing and arithmetic, I felt to be no less a burden and an infliction than the entire series of Greek classes. The root of this aversion must simply have been sin and the vanity of life, by which I was mere flesh and wind going on its way and not returning. Of course, those first elements of the language were better, because more fundamental. On that foundation, I came to acquire the faculty which I had, and still possess, of being able to read whatever I find written, and to write myself whatever I wish. This was better than the poetry I was later forced to learn about the wanderings of some legendary fellow named Aeneas, forgetful of my own wanderings, and weeping over the death of a Dido, who took her own life for love. While reading this, O God, my life, I myself was dying of my alienation from you, and my miserable condition in that respect brought no tear to my eyes. What is more pitiable than a wretch without pity for himself who weeps over the death of Dido dying for love of Aeneas, but not over himself dying for lack of love for you, my God, light of my heart, bread of the inner mouth of my soul, the power which begets life in my mind and in the innermost recesses of my thinking. Over this I wept not a tear. I wept over Dido, who died in pursuing her ultimate end with a sword. I abandoned you to pursue the lowest things of your creation. I was dust going to dust. Had I been forbidden to read this story, I would have been sad that I could not read what made me sad. Such madness is considered a higher and more fruitful literary education than being taught to read and write. Let no critic shout against me. I'm not afraid of them now, while I confess to you the longing of my soul, my God, and when I accept rebuke for my evil ways and wish to love your good ways. Let there be no abuse of me from people who sell or buy a literary education. If I put the question to them whether the poet's story is true, that Aeneas once came to Carthage, the uneducated will reply that they do not know, while the educated will say it is false. But if I ask them with what letters Aeneas's name is spelt, all who have learned to read will reply correctly, in accordance with the agreement and convention by which human beings have determined the value of these signs. Similarly, if I ask which would cause the greater inconvenience to someone's life, to forget how to read and write, or to forget these fables, who does not see what answer he would give, unless he has totally lost his senses? So it was a sin in me as a boy, when I gave pride of place in my affection to those empty fables rather than to more useful studies, or rather when I hated the one and loved the other. But to me it was a hateful chant to recite 1 and 1 is 2 and 2 and 2 are 4. Delightful was the vain spectacle of the wooden horse full of armed soldiers and the burning of Troy and the very ghost of Creusa.
So why does Augustine think it's sin and vanity, peccatum et vanitas, that he found Latin language distasteful to learn as a child, but later, as a boy, loved Latin literature dearly? Why was the boy so wrong to weep over the fate of Dido, as many readers of Virgil's epic poem The Aeneid have done since? Dido, the queen of Carthage, who died from desire for the wandering hero Aeneas. For Augustine, the hero of the epic poem is directed by a false-god Jupiter towards a meaningless achievement, the foundation of an earthly empire, while Dido suffers from a false emotion, human passion rather than desire for God. Augustine argues here that literacy in Latin is far more important in education than Latin literature. Reading, writing, and speaking Latin are absolutely necessary skills for life. But its literature is full of fabulous fables which stimulate false emotions. Yet paradoxically, Augustine seems to have drawn on Virgil's epic poem better to shape his own life story. Like Aeneas, the hero of the Confessions wanders across stormy seas, seeks to interpret the commands of a distant father, suffers uncertainty, and is temporarily diverted from his true purpose, bisexual desire. Paradoxically, too, Augustine does not use the Latin of everyday speech to shape the narrative of his Christian conversion, but puts into play all the rhetorical techniques and literary devices which he had learned from his unholy education in Latin prose and poetry. His early training in the ornate and ample style of Cicero's speeches, and his later career as professor of rhetoric, selling words in the bazaar of loquacity, have both contributed to the polyphony of his Latin, which slides in and out of different registers, at the same time as it ingeniously intersperses the imagery and the rhythms of the Psalms. Augustine presents the recollections of his life not as a reverie for himself, nor, at least on the surface, as an instruction for his readers. Instead, the Confessions are structured as a prose poem to God. The author confesses his weaknesses to God and beseeches God directly for enlightenment. In the passage you have just heard, he describes God as the light of my heart, bread of the inner mouth of my soul, the power which gives my mind in marriage to the recesses of my thought. Lumen cordis mei, et panis oris intus animae meae, et virtus, maritans mentem meam et sinum cogitationis meae. The imagery here is arresting. God is light, bread, and the power to create union. While Augustine's soul possesses a hungry mouth, his lonely mind is given a husband. His thought contains secret recesses, or folds like those in a tunic. In this early section of the Confessions, Augustine goes on to consider why, when he had loved Latin literature, did he so hate Greek.
Why, then, did I hate Greek, which has similar songs to sing? Homer was skilled at weaving such stories, and with sheer delight mixed vanity. Yet to me, as a boy, he was repellent. I can well believe that Greek boys feel the same about Virgil when they are forced to learn him in the way that I learnt Homer. The difficulty lies there, the difficulty of learning a foreign language at all. It sprinkles gall, as it were, over all the charm of the stories the Greeks tell. I did not know any of the words, and violent pressure on me to learn them was imposed by means of fearful and cruel punishments. At one time, in my infancy, I also knew no Latin, and yet by listening I learnt it with no fear or pain at all. From my nurses caressing me, from people laughing over jokes, and from those who played games and were enjoying them. I learnt Latin without the threat of punishment from anyone forcing me to learn it. My own heart constrained me to bring its concepts to birth, which I could not have done unless I had learned some words, not from formal teaching, but by listening to people talking. And they, in turn, were the audience for my thoughts.
As a boy, Augustine hated studying Greek because it was a foreign language. In the late 4th century, Greek was spoken as the official language of the eastern half of the Roman Empire. Homer, then, was difficult to learn because a boy in Roman Africa would be unfamiliar with Greek words. Schoolchildren of subsequent centuries might suffer the same discomforts over Virgil. Not so for the young Augustine. The Western Mediterranean, north and south, belonged to a single Latin culture, even if that Latin was spoken with different regional accents. In his small African town, the child Augustine learned Latin not through cruel punishments in a classroom, but by listening to it spoken in the most enjoyable of circumstances, in the midst of caresses, jokes, and games. It is delightful for us now to be reminded that Latin was once a language alive and vibrant. The Confessions are a remembrance of a past life, designed to invite a readership of Christians across the Latin world to break from their own past lives, to accept divine intervention, as Augustine had done, and to lift their minds and affections up to God. For the author, his written life was in microcosm the entire story of creation, the fall, and salvation. Augustine was the prodigal son, who had wasted his inheritance, lived on pigswill, and in anguish finally found his way back home. He describes the moment of his conversion, as when, in the garden of his house in Milan, he heard a voice like a child's repeating the Latin refrain, Tolle lege, tolle lege, pick up and read. Trained in the classical past, speaking for Christianity's future, that is what this Latin voice calls upon us still to do. Tolle lege, pick up and read Augustine's texts, for they could change your life.